You are listening to the Poetry Salon Cast. The Poetry Salon is on a mission to provide inspiration, education, and access to a high-quality artistic community at a price that is affordable. If you want to find out more about the Poetry Salon and join one of our many online workshops, take one of our e-courses, or come to one of our readings or book club discussions, find out more about us and how you can join at www.thepoetrysalon.com. Now, enjoy our interview with our featured guest artist.
You ready? Miss Atomic Blast. 1951 Vegas was young, small, and ignorant, if not innocent. Six hotels on the strip, Sinatra debuted at the Desert Inn, and the Nevada test site became a spectacle. Calendars were given with detonation times, best places to watch, showgirls and singers, craps and blasts. Who could ask for anything more? Atomic cocktails and penthouse views, sunglasses and souvenirs, toys and candies, dawn bomb parties to revel in the lighting of a night sky. A sans chorus girl danced on Angel's Peak as Test Cloud bloomed behind. Her poses named apprehension and awe, impact and survival. Tests were named Annie and Priscilla, Hornet and Bee. At the El Rancho, a young dancer was crowned Miss Atomic Blast, awarded 10 pounds of mushrooms. In 1957, another showgirl won Miss Atomic Bomb, icon of blonde curls, red lips, white bikini with cotton mushroom from hips to chin. Flash blinded sheep, Joshua trees smoldered, burns killed livestock. But general said, the worst was a mouthful of dirt. The government said, no danger outside the bombing range. 41 years, 928 tests. Soldiers who witnessed were more likely to die from leukemia, prostate, and throat cancers. And now, as fans of TV's Chernobyl rush to relish its devastation, the U.S. Department of Energy offers tours of the Nevada test site, calls Sedan Crater the perfect place for a group photo. The pit created by 104 kiloton device, 630 feet underground. Radiation signs hang from wire fences. The tour is booked out for a year. After the gold rush, riparian corridors wended to silty loam, heavy clay soils, alkali salts. Delta dreams ebbed and flowed. Chinese forced to leave. Japanese streamed in. Railroads, mines, and farms. Rice imported from Asia, South America. Where the Maidu tended oak for acorns, gathered greens and berries, Kenju Ikuta showed the possibility of grain from hard pan soil, black adobe. Profit and praise, rice became the new gold. 1 year later, Japanese could not own farms. In 1920, Committee on Immigration and Naturalization read a pamphlet by Chester Verstig. California, he wrote, owed a debt to the Japanese, called Ikuta a pioneer. But they were not, he argued, entitled to have land, be citizens. In World War II, rice plantings delayed, fields foul with weeds, Issei, Nisei, and Sansei were gathered and interned, became field hands for government farms, potatoes and daikon, grains and hay sold on open markets. In 1964, rice production at record highs, 24 years before reparations, the U.S. Board on Geographic Names designated a summit that overlooks Manzanar, 20 miles to the east, Mount Bearstig. When I was young, I grew near the remnants of Japantown, was told of Manzanar and Tule Lake by neighbors, fathers of friends. When I was young, my seasons were marked by rice. Spring meant flooding planted wetlands. Fall, the burn after harvests.
Ladies and gentlemen, Poetry Salon listeners, you have been listening to the writings of Heather Bourbeau. Her latest book is Monarch.
But I'm very, very grateful to be here, and I'm always happy to encourage the intellectual deep dive.
Well, and I think this book, you know, all books of poetry, of course, will do that in one way or another. I want to ask, what is the name of the publisher again?
Cornerstone Press.
Thank you. So if listeners have not read the book yet, you can get a copy from Cornerstone Press. It is a book called Monarch, but on the cover, you will see a bear, the California bear. We'll talk about why that is in a little bit. The book is very informed by history. We've been talking about it in our poetry group as being a history book as a poetry book as a history book. And so if you're coming to this book, you might also walk away with homework. Yeah. You have noted that it has quite an extensive bibliography. So I wonder if you could say a little bit in your own words about what the book is about and also how you got motivated, interested in writing about this topic.
Yeah, so when I was pitching the book, even polishing up my elevator pitch for myself as much as anybody else, as I was starting to put the collection together, I called it a poetic memoir from the U.S. West I was raised in. I was born and raised part of the time in Reno, and then we moved to Sacramento, where I finished out high school. But my mom was fifth generation Oregonian. My dad was second generation from Spokane, Washington. So we grew up traveling quite a bit through these areas several times a year. And we were in a sort of nerdy family, I guess. I mean, I don't think of that when I think back on my family, but I guess not every family has a family member. I'm looking at you, Dad, who reads every plaque and wants to learn. You know, before there was Google, he would learn more. So I thought that we had a pretty healthy sense of history. And these were really the histories I wish I had been told. And so many of them, you know, you could read it as a straight history or listen to it on a history podcast. And maybe you would feel some of the gut punch or feel your personal relationship to it. But for me, entering into poetry and bringing these stories in through poetry was a way for it to feel more personal and to explore my own family's relationship to this land.
Something you just said, you thought you had a good sense of history, but as it turns out, you don't. Can you speak to that a little bit more and how that manifests in the book?
Yeah, I mean, as an adult, I have, you know, greater awareness of the fact that history is written from a very specific point of view and not just the view of the victor, right? It's also written by people with often an agenda, and it's manipulated to fit an agenda, right? There we have a lot of founding father myths in this country, for instance, mm-hmm. that we can point to, but that it's everywhere. We were fed this idea of manifest destiny.
I don't know how I would describe that facial expression you just made. Concerned, eye rolling. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but...
Oh, God, no. Yeah. No, I mean, it's just this question, the fact that we even have the term manifest destiny, right? As if this land in the middle and western parts of this country were uninhabited and there for the white people, mm-hmm. including my family. I mean, we are not blameless in this scenario. We were homesteaders to Oregon. So we got our 320 or 640 acres mm-hmm. and, on land that was unceded.
Well, and that's a great segue to a question I want to ask. In this book, you write quite a bit about the history of people who look differently from you or I. And I think there's a lot of poets who have social conscience and they want to address issues that relate to people of other culture. And I'm wondering how you went about that and what advice you might offer to other writers who are confronting the bigness of history and maybe some stories that, they feel maybe aren't exactly their stories to tell.
Sure. Well, I wasn't writing in anyone else's voice. So I wasn't pretending to be part of a community I am not.
Yeah.
This really is the history that would have helped me have a more holistic relationship to the land and the land I come from, and the communities that we engaged with multi-generationally. Mm-hmm. And I'd say the first thing is don't write in a voice that is not authentic to you.
Yeah.
I also, beyond the ES 21 page bibliography that is available at Cornerstone Press, there's also a teaching guide that is available both on Cornerstone Press's website, along with the Monarch information. But beyond that, I also, before doing anything, I checked in with people who were experts and also members of these communities. Where I tried to, there were a couple times where I had to do secondhand. There were not verifications that could happen at certain tribal levels. Mm-hmm. So those were had to be secondhand, not direct. But I did make every effort with the ones that I couldn't get. I did talk to five or six different people from, I really made a good college effort to get in touch with everybody and make sure I wasn't saying anything that was, first off, offensive, and second of all, misrepresenting a history. Because again, a lot of the history that I was able to access in terms of available research is often not written from the point of view of these particular communities. And so really making sure and double checking that it was okay what I was writing, that it was appropriate, that I was taking care of their beliefs mm-hmm. appropriately as well, because there are references to religious beliefs.
Yeah.
And so I did make every effort. And in a couple times there were tweaks as a result. And that includes with not just different communities, indigenous voices and people, communities of color, but also LGBTQ voices that I, in histories that I look at as well. And I did tweak here and there to make it more accurate and more appropriate.
Was there anything in particular you learned from talking with those who know more about it than you do? Anything that really surprised you of significance, or was it all, pretty much small tweaks here and there?
I wouldn't say surprised me, but tweaks that showed my own bias for sure. Yeah. So as much as I feel like I have many people in my larger circle of friends and community that might represent, I'm thinking of one poem in particular where I thought I had been sensitive to everything, and then it was just very clear, I dead named a trans person and didn't think about what that meant.
Can you say that again? You dead named?
Yeah, so I gave their birth name. I used their birth name in the beginning of the poem before they transitioned. Mm-hmm. But that's not who they were. That's the name their parents used for them. Mm. Right? And so when they legally became Alan, I had to change the rhythm of the poem, but in the service of the greater good. I let go of rhythm.
I think that's also a very interesting question that's relevant for those who write and write about history, because in poetry, so often we are encouraging our students or ourselves to have some freedom and play with the imagination. And I frequently say something that I read in Richard Hugo's book, The Triggering Town, which is that you owe the truth about reality nothing. You owe your feelings about reality everything, which I think is useful advice when you're writing poetry. But then once you are writing a historical piece, and yours is definitely not coming out saying, I'm the imagination of Heather Bourbeau. It is very explicitly about real life history. You find yourself with many more constraints. Were there any times when, maybe history got in the way of what you wanted to say, or were you just letting history do the talking? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I would also first like to say that I want people to question my own perspective in this. I want people to come away questioning where the history that they've learned came from and who wrote it and what was happening at the time that it was written. I'm really seeing everything in the larger context.
Yeah.
And I welcome people questioning the biases that I come from, because I am a human walking in this world. In terms of the history, there were a couple times where I thought, this is going to be, I'd come across something and I'd write it, scribble it down, do some deep dive. And then I'd be like, it's not boring, but I'm not connecting to it. It's not necessarily a history that informed my relationship to this land, and so it wasn't really true to the sense of the project, for sure. And then there were times where I thought I was going to be doing something, and then the rabbit hole led me to a completely different place.
I mean, I think that one is universal, and poets, if you haven't had this experience yet, try it. At least speaking from my own experience, I often have something else comes up as I'm writing. Part of the creative process I find mysterious. And then when you throw research into it, as you do, and you're opening yourself up to finding more and more information that you didn't have access to at the beginning, of course you're going to be led into paths you weren't expecting. I also will say, for listeners who don't know, we have a Poetry Salon book club, and we don't always get the writers of the books to join us, but Heather did come to our book club, and we had a really wonderful, robust discussion with you, Heather, about the book, and some of our members raised some questions and gave some reflection of their own that enhanced my own understanding of the book. And one thing that we talked about, I think, with the poem Prometheus and the Pinecone.
Mm-hmm. Prometheus Felled.
Mm-hmm. Prometheus Felled. Would you just very briefly give a synopsis of that poem?
Yeah, so this comes from the bristlecone pines in Nevada are the, at the time, considered the oldest organic. There are some caveats, and I think the caveat is oldest organic organism on Earth. They're over, some of them are over several thousand years old. But they didn't know that. They had some suspicions, but they didn't know that when they cored one of them, I believe he was a grad student at the time, and with somebody from the Park Service to assist him doing research, and he didn't know. And that the way that they had cored it, actually, they destroyed it, they killed it. And it was only in counting the rings and looking at the density of the rings that they realized they had killed the oldest, what they thought at the time was the oldest living organic organism on the planet. And they named it Prometheus. That was not me being super clever. That was they were super clever, because he immediately felt horrible. And his urgings and talking to Congress and a bunch of other actions that he took, along with different people of the Park Service and the researchers in his lab, led to the protection of that area.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I do really like that story, because obviously it's terrible to accidentally, or without, being fully informed, cut down one of the oldest living things on the planet. But he did learn from it. And hopefully there's something that comes out of it that, it sounds like there was something that came out of it that will prevent that from happening again. I think it's a compassionate story to tell, in that it's compassionate towards our human foibles. It's not just making one person a good guy and one person a bad guy. This is, I think, the trick with writing anything that is political or historical, which is that if you can really make things so clear cut that we know there's a good guy and there's a bad guy, then it's probably not going to lend itself to discovery or really challenge our own understanding of ourselves, So you always want your poem, even if it is making commentary or exploring something in a political way, you do want to come to it with an understanding of people being multifaceted and yourself being not 100% right or knowledgeable or informed, and questioning your own biases. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about how you went about looking for these stories. Are these all things that sprung up because of traveling around the West Coast? Were there some places where you had to actively go looking for inspiration? Like, I don't know anything about this place. Let's go and see if there's something interesting here. Can you just talk about that process a little?
Sure. So there were some things that I knew because of growing up, I wanted to revisit things that I wanted to dive a little deeper into. Yeah, again, these stories that I kind of half knew or partly knew, or areas that I knew in my gut but didn't know in my head. I don't know how to explain that, but we would go every summer to the Siskiyou. Left his family and became a hermit gold miner, and we had gold claims in the family up until the early 90s up there. And we would spend, several weeks or months up there every summer. And so that geography is very deep in my soul. I love it. It's precious to me. And I knew nothing about the history of the actual geography. So I didn't know, I started thinking, I'm like, well, shoot, we've done some, dredging. And I know, like, my generation, so I can only imagine previous generations, how are they mining? And you know, what's dammed, what's not dammed. So I started looking into like the river itself. And, you know, that just opened a can of worms. Yeah. And then there were things that I'm a little bit of a nerd. So I listened to some like history podcasts for fun. And there would be times where something would come up and I'd be like, what? No, it would be some tiny off, you know, comment that was part of this other story. But my brain would just hook onto it and I would do a big deep dive. So yeah, East Bay yesterday inspired a couple poems in the book. Because again, they just made some like reference to something and I ran to gobble, 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 more, more, more.
Well, I have a feeling that a lot of us poets are nerds in one way or the other. If it's not about history, it's about something else we love. For some of us, it's poetry and we're just listening to poetry podcasts all the time. I know, and I think I can call her out by name, but my friend Kelly Grace Thomas, whenever I talk to her, she's like, oh, I heard this thing on this poetry podcast. Did you hear the interview with Patricia Smith? Did you hear the interview? I was listening to this while I was driving today. She's just always learning about poetry and filling her brain with it and studying the craft itself. I think you have to be a little bit nerdy about something. If you have some kind of obsession, it's going to help you as a writer stay continuously inspired. You know, clearly this is a really big topic, and I would imagine there's no way of ever being really finished with it. So at what point did you decide you were finished enough to turn this into an actual book?
Well, I think I may be unique in this. Like I had the structure of the book in my head once I decided it was a book. So I had started with one poem, Man Named Remembrance Recalls the Gold Rush. Mm. And that was because I had access to these memoirs from this man named Remembrance Campbell, who was a child during the California Gold Rush. You know, so again, it's this question of what the history is that you remember when mm-hmm. you're a little kid. And he's definitely coming at it from a certain point of view. Whites who came from the middle of this country. It's this toss-offs that people would say, right? He would just sort of toss off that, oh yeah, and then it's like the bear and bull fights, as if that's a completely normal thing just to like throw out there. Oh, you know, the 4th of July, bear and bull fights. And so then I started doing more research into it. And it turns out bear and bull fights were actually a totally normal thing that were happening all over the Gold Rush areas. Insane. So, and taxes on people, you know, they would tax the Chinese $5 to be able to pan, and they would like the things that I learned just in researching because of this guy's young person view, you know, and just being like, wait, what? Like, that can't be real. That must be a 5-year-old or 6-year-old's memory. And then realizing that the reality was even crazier than what he remembered. And so that poem came out, and then I was on the road to see our old claims. So they long since not been our claims, but I went up in talking with the Salmon River Restoration Council, as one does, and getting all this information. But just I was like, oh, this could be a book. And I think I had Fugo maybe by that point as well. I didn't really have a book per se in my head. And then with the Salmon River Council, it just was like, I have the structure. This should be a timeline. I want 10 poems, 4 states, a list poem at the end, timeline at the beginning. So I think once I had that and I had the 8 in between that I felt good with, I felt like, okay, I could walk away.
That's wonderful. And I think that can be very useful too, because especially if you're obsessed with something or you're talking about a really big topic, you could get caught saying, I'm just going to keep working on this forever and it will never be finished. I'm looking at you, Walt Whitman, Song of Myself. And I think setting a deadline or a number, a form, and saying once it's this many poems, it can be very useful for, let's say, some of us who just don't know how to set limits for ourselves. I'm looking at you, man in the mirror, woman in the mirror.
My friend Vince Montague, whose memoir, which I would say is a poetic memoir, is called Cracked Pot, and it's about his dealing with grief and going into ceramics. He's a writer who turned to ceramics to get through the loss of his wife. He and I saw him at a art show in Marin County, north of here, and it was raining and there were very few people. And I knew I had gone on this big hike and I knew he was showing at this art show. So I just came down to like say, hey, you know, I'm here to support you. You're amazing. And we started, he's like, I've got this project, but it's not really a straightforward memoir. And I said, you should just do it, dude. Who needs genre? Like, do it. Trust your voice. And then I told him, oh, I have this idea of maybe doing this. I said, but it's kind of kooky. And I kind of had, and he's like, just do it. So we gave each other permission. And then we set a deadline for each other.
Oh, wow.
And we said, okay, by, I think it was either June and then got pushed back to August, or it was August and got pushed back to September or something. By the next year, we wanted to have completed manuscripts.
I love that. I want to know more about that. Did that help? Do you feel like it?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Absolutely. I think I would have just been like, oh, maybe I'll turn to one of these poems now and not been so immersed in the research and all these different ways to research and these different gold mines, including, you know, humans who I wouldn't have been tapped into as much because I wouldn't have felt the time pressure.
This is an issue for me that I find, I don't know if controversial is the right word, unpredictable. It's hard to know what's going to work for the right person or the right topic or what have you, because I think there are people and conditions where an artist had a deadline and it ruined the project because they didn't have enough time to really let it simmer and do the work that it needed to do. And yet there's other times where absolutely that time crunch motivates you or just allows you to make it a priority. I'm not going to weigh in one way or the other. I think it's one of those mysterious things in art that sometimes it works. If you try it and it doesn't work for you, it doesn't mean you need to abandon the project. Just, you know, move the deadline back a little farther and try it again and see if that helps.
Totally. I mean, like you heard, we did move the deadline.
Yes.
Once. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we both had gotten enough momentum that we saw it as an honest deadline when we moved it.
Well, I will bring this in. So again, me being a nerd, there's a wonderful TED Talk. It's about how procrastination works, how to use it effectively. And the person presenting the TED Talk says, it's not enough to arbitrarily just procrastinate on something. What you want to do is start it and get some information, get some water in the well, some grist for the mill, then procrastinate in the middle. And then, you know, possibly put a deadline or pull an all-nighter late at night. But the idea is that having that stuff in your mind gets your wheels going, allows your unconscious mind to work some things out, and allows you to basically have the time to let it germinate. You're not quitting. You are sending it down to the unconscious department. They're going to work on it for a little while you go hit the treadmill or climb a tree or stare at those bluebirds and try to figure out what kind of bluebirds those are. It's a form of work. It's a form of work we often don't recognize as such.
For sure. Yeah. As many a good farmer knows, you need to have some fallow.
Yes.
Time for the richness of the soil.
I think it's Anne Lamott says in Bird by Bird, like, is there no better metaphor for life than the garden? And it's always, it comes to that very often. on the topic of taking some time off and kind of letting your poetry brain have some self-care or proper rest, you're researching some difficult topics. And I just want readers to be forewarned. Some of the poems I found, you know, they introduced me to some knowledge that was challenging to have. And a few poems did make me sort of put the book down and go, I need to go for a walk now. So you're dealing with some of these very difficult topics. And what, as a writer, did you do for your own self-care, for your own preservation as you subjected yourself to this research?
Yeah, I guess I'm going to first, if I may, object to the term subjective.
I was actually just thinking that. I was like,
yeah.
Is that because the right term?
I think taking in, right? Taking in this research. Because the problem is when we don't know these histories, we are currently repeating several of them, including all the anti-Asian hateful acts that we're seeing currently today. And if we knew better, and we knew even the debt that we owe a lot of these immigrants and the depth of their connection to the West and how they were here at the same time as the first white people, maybe we would have a different relationship with each other, and we wouldn't be operating out of fear so much. Maybe, hopefully. But it is hard, and a lot of these stories are very hard. And I definitely believe in finding whatever works for you to create some sort of meditative practice and gratitude practice. I think grounding and gratitude is incredibly important. And having it not just be, oh, I'm grateful for these things, grounding it in, I'm grateful for these things, and here's my role in putting myself in that place to be there, to have those things. And so recognizing your own agency in positive things, I think is one way to really help not feel depleted, because when you take in horrible news from far away in the world that's happening currently, or you take in news even close by, but you don't have any way to immediately connect with it or make it better, I think finding the ways that you can make things better, ways that you can make your own life better, ways that you can make your community better immediately, finding ways for positive agency is a huge way for me to feel more grounded, more connected, and not overwhelmed by secondhand witnessing, or sometimes firsthand witnessing, depending on where I'm at and what's happening in the world. But I very much encourage people, if you're feeling overwhelmed by the history that you read in Monarch, find some way that you can make the present ripple effect of that history better. And hopefully that'll make you feel better and more connected and like you're helping not right a historical wrong per se, because I don't know what that even means, but you're writing a better future.
Yeah. And how appropriate is that writing, WRITRIGHT. Mm-hmm. I think in addition to that, what you said was also shake it off. Literally.
Oh, for sure. Oh yeah, literally shake it off. Oh yeah, that's a huge thing for me. So a big thing with trauma and experiencing or witnessing or ingesting trauma in any form, somatically we trap all that anxiety and fear and shame and all those things that come with trauma. And if you literally just, you know, Mariah Carey or Taylor Swift, whichever, you know, you shake off your body. We're the only mammal that doesn't do that. So if you see dogs, because that's the easiest one around here, right? But when they have some flip out with another dog, or there's, you know, a squirrel or whatever it is that's like making them on alert. And then when that's gone, they do a little shimmy, a little shake, because they're literally shaking that energy out of their system.
Yeah.
And we need to do that as well.
Well, and I think it's interesting. If I can psych nerd out here a little bit, they both of those things work in the same way, because we're a very reactive species. You see something bad, you get a shot of adrenaline, and you want to go act or react to something. So here we are, often sitting on the couch, turning on the news, seeing something terrible, and your mind gets this adrenaline shot because it's preparing your body to go address the issue. But if it's something happening on the other side of the world and you can't address it, or it's something that happened in the past, you can't address it, you know, that adrenaline is misplaced. So it's so effective. And I say this to myself because I need this advice all the time. This should be my ringtone on my phone. The advice, you know, the best thing you can do for yourself in times like that is go for a walk or a dance or some kind of physical activity. Mm-hmm. Or as your other suggestion, you know, you find a way to react to it in a positive way that hopefully can be helpful and useful.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm a big proponent. I mean, I do it even when somebody tells me some horrible personal tragedy or news. I find myself now just instinctively doing a little shimmy.
Yeah.
So that I can be fully present for them and not just hold fear in my body.
So I want to make a hard turn here now, talking about the psychological. Yeah, the psychological aspects, back to the craft.
Sure.
You read two poems at the beginning, and I want to know which one was the easier one and which one was the harder one.
Yeah. So in terms of craft, not the research, definitely Miss Atomic Blast was the easier one to write. Also in terms of research, it was one of the easier ones because I knew I wanted, as you know, somebody originally from Nevada, that I wanted to talk about the, I wouldn't say blasé nature that people had towards the absolute destruction of Southern Nevada. But yeah, the callousness with which people just, you know, are like, oh yeah, we'll have Yucca Mountain and we'll have, anyway, that's one that sort of, it doesn't really write itself, but you know, it's much easier for me. Then after the Gold Rush, basically started as two poems. So I knew I wanted to write a poem. I did, when we moved to Sacramento, we lived near the rice fields when the rice was burning. I knew it was, you know, harvest season. You know, we had just finished harvest, and I knew I could smell the flooding, and I could smell, you know, part canine with my nose, I guess. But yeah, the seasons were marked by rice. And we lived near Japantown. And so I had some sense of the early connection of the Japanese. I mean, I definitely had a sense of the early connection of the Japanese migration to California and Nevada. And so I knew I wanted to talk about rice, and I knew I wanted to talk about Japanese internment. I didn't realize that they were interconnected. That was one where I got real nerdy and was looking at, like, researching early rice crops and when the first rice came to California and how it came, and rice yields at different years, early years, and going all the way through. And then I saw that it was really hinging on this one Japanese immigrant, Tenchu Akuta. And I'd had, originally I thought maybe Manzanar was going to be a list poem of the children born. I thought, well, maybe, you know, maybe people will have more sympathy or empathy if they see the children born, they were incarcerated. You know, the more I dug into that that Rice one, the more I saw that they were absolutely connected, and that, you know, these early Japanese farmers who transformed California's economy couldn't, you know, they couldn't own their farms.
Yeah.
They couldn't be US citizens. You know, there was talk of denying their children the right to be citizens. But this guy, Chester Verstig, you know, he wrote this pamphlet that was just like ridiculous. So then I was like, who is this guy? Like, who, you know, why is he getting, first of all, to have a pamphlet included in a whole collection of papers that were presented to Congress? And it turns out he was just a lawyer in Southern California who had some opinions and printed some pamphlets. And he later on became very active in the Sierra Club. And the Sierra Club petitioned the Geographical Names Division of the government to name this mountain that coincidentally was near Manzanar, Mount Verestig. It was hard because I did not see how all those different threads were going to come together. I certainly didn't expect it.
Yeah.
It was a much bigger, like, okay, what am I going to choose to bring all these, to whittle it down into a poem? And hopefully it's successful at conveying that deep thread that really did start from a personal connection.
I can't remember when I first learned about Manzanar. I'm imagining it was probably World War II, our unit on World War II in 10th grade. It may have been when we were driving up and down California and my parents introducing me to it. But yeah, we know about that, of course, because I used to be in California. Yeah, not everyone knows that. I think that's actually, of all the stories and histories in your book, that's probably one of the lesser surprising ones. I mean, people at least know about Manzanar, even if they don't know about some of the rules against people from Asian countries even being able to own land. They were allowed to work the land, they just weren't allowed to own it. And they really transformed the economy of California without really getting to, you know, take that ownership of it. So some of that, it took something I knew and it informed me even further about what was going on and the particular rules and just the harshness and the severity and the limitations put on people who didn't look like the founding fathers. Mm-hmm. And then there's some other stories that, you know, I had absolutely no idea about at all, like Snowshoe Thompson. and I won't ask you to read that poem right now, but I will definitely encourage folks to get the book and to read some of the other poems we're referencing here. If you teach history or you're just interested in it, you should especially look these up. Heather, I think one of the things that your book can do for those who are interested in history and also for those who are interested in writing and writing about history is it really does invite you to, it invites the reader to ask, what do I not know about my own state, my own hometown, the history here that's not spoken? I think a lot of us are in this position of really not knowing what our own history is. For you, what's one of the things you hope people get out of reading this book and out of getting clued in just a little bit more to the history of the West?
Yeah, I hope people have a better understanding of the richness of the land and the communities that lived and live upon this land. I also hope that people have a bit more humility when it comes to their relationships with each other and the land. You know, hopefully it gets taught or people teach these larger histories, these a deeper understanding and question more broadly the history that we've been taught, and not to completely disregard the history we've been taught, but to just say what's missing. Whose perspective is missing and why? And how do we bring that in? How do we start these conversations with each other? Because sometimes that history is taught amongst different communities.
Yeah.
Right. And I would say even like women's history, women read women's history. Right.
Yes. Yes.
So the goal is to have broader communities learning each other's histories deeper so that we have ultimately greater respect and care for each other and the land we live on.
Well, I hope people get that from you too. And a little bit or from this book as well. In a more concrete way, I will say it got me studying some more of my own history. So, I mean, I guess I'll just say, you know, everyone should be informed. Light, it's education. So, you know, I think everyone, in keeping with the spirit of democracy, we should get educated. We should know what we're supposed to be, you know, ask what hasn't been taught and take some time to get to know it ourselves.
Here's something that I think most Californians don't, I certainly didn't know about until, I don't know, fairly recently, maybe the last 10 years or something. The program in the late 50s and early 60s to de-land California indigenous people.
No.
So have you ever thought about why there aren't very many reservations in California?
No, I have not.
So I have just only because in Reno proper, there's a colony. In Nevada, they call them colonies. Mm. So there's a colony that's Paiute, Northern Paiute, Western Shoshone, and Washoe. Mm. And I just grew up knowing within 45 minutes of me, there were three different colonies. Mm-hmm. And then I get to California, I'm like, it's so bizarre. Like, what? I know there must be indigenous people. Where yeah. are, you know, what's happening? And then, you know, the child brain takes over and creates a narrative. When
yeah.
When there's a gap in knowledge, right? And so I'm like, oh, they must be really well integrated. And I've been getting, you know, they must have gotten. No, it's because California systematically took land away from them in the 50s and 60s. And there were laws against. Yeah. I mean, look it up. It's brutal.
Yeah. I don't doubt it. I'm glad that I asked you about how you deal with this knowledge. I know that after this, I had already just coincidentally scheduled a trip to the gym. Because I need, yeah. I don't mean that to sound like, you know, glib.
No. I just love that I'm, and I don't mean to sound sort of glib about these histories. I hope that's not what's coming through.
Yeah.
I'm just laughing because it's like, oh yeah, I talked to Heather. So now I need to like. Yeah. The other one, I'm gonna leave you with this tasty tidbit, mm-hmm. which also, so I thought I was gonna do a rancheria, which is what California called the reservation system. I thought I was gonna do a poem about that, and in the end, that led to a rabbit hole that led to something else. But the other one that I thought maybe of doing a poem on, the fortune cookie. Mm. Do you know the origin of the fortune cookie?
As far as I know, it originated in San Francisco and not China.
Correct. It is a San Franciscan invention from a Japanese immigrant, Makoto Hagiwara, who you may know from the Japanese Tea Garden, one of the creators of the Japanese Tea Garden in Golden Gate Park. And for that, he redesigned or sort of reconceived a traditional Japanese cookie. How did it get to be connected to Chinese restaurants? Because of the incarceration of the Japanese during World War II. They lost their factories and Chinese immigrants took over those factories.
Oh, wow.
We're able to mass produce.
Just a simple fortune cookie. In some ways, you know, that can be such a microcosm of, I don't know. I don't want to blame just America. It's certainly not, we're not the only people who treat other people badly, but it's definitely a microcosm of, let's say, human nature. You know, the history behind something can tell you so much, and some terrible histories can be repackaged and reappropriated for, you know, profit. You know, and that's, I think I find, after I went to college, in fact, I remember going through a period of about a year where I just couldn't do or eat anything, because whenever I went anywhere, I was like, this lettuce on my veggie burger comes from Salinas, and the gas and the fossil fuels burn to move it from Salinas down here. And the people, I was just overwhelmed by this knowledge of how, you know, the negative side effects of everyday life.
Sure. But you could also take that knowledge and say, oh my God, look, first of all, how ingenious of one immigrant group to recognize a desire, like these cookies were becoming popular. Mm. And rather than losing it, like, let's keep it going. And it, again, like, here's an opportunity to maybe rethink, like, because there was a huge debate in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, when there was talk, and then eventually there were some reparations for the incarceration of Japanese. You know, this is a very straightforward example that you can point to say, like, yeah, here were full families whose, you know, livelihoods were taken away from them. And not, I'm not going to say they were taken away by the Chinese, because they weren't. They were taken away by the U.S. government.
Yeah.
And the U.S. government absolutely owed them reparations. And so for me, it's like, it gives you context to these larger efforts at reparations and reconciliation, and maybe having more robust and deeper conversations about it. Because you can understand when you look at that fortune cookie, you can have a greater understanding and appreciation for everything that happened with that fortune cookie.
That is a much healthier way. I wish I had had this book and had you to talk to after graduating college.
I also want to challenge you and everybody who's listening to write a poem about the fortune cookie.
Oh my goodness.
I would love to read everybody's poems about the fortune cookie. Do the poem I didn't do.
Yeah. One more thing I absolutely have to ask you. Who are some of the writers that you want to shout out, or you would recommend to us, you know, from some of the cultures and the histories that you touched on in the book? I mean, do you have other favorite California writers, let's put it that way?
Yeah. There are a lot of people whose work I adore in terms of poetry, but let me just give you a few folks who I think their research is fascinating. First of all, your national parks or state parks, like Allensworth State Park. And you can go there right now. You can also experience the regaining of the Tulare Lake Basin, which is so crazy. And unfortunately, because we drained the lake, which had a profound negative repercussions as well as positive. Allensworth was a, a Black utopian community, essentially, that I write about. Then that state park is a huge resource. Your Angel Island is a huge resource. Anyway, there's lots of resources. Professor Darrell Milner's writings, Johanna Ogden's writings, Lewis Warren's writings. These guys, you know, get into some juicy history that's often overlooked. In terms of poetry, many people in Copper Canyon Press, like I can just direct people to different presses, Omnidon, Copper Canyon, they have a lot of authors that deal with these topics, really.
That's awesome. I think that'll keep readers busy for a couple of years. Yeah.
And there's terrain.org. I also want to recommend them.
Yes. Yeah. They're fantastic. So, so for listeners, really, I want to encourage you to get Monarch from Cornerstone Press, by Heather Bourbeau. There is a teaching guide that you can order from Cornerstone Press as well. So if you are thinking about bringing this to your students, if you want to create a study group or just a book club for other interested individuals to discuss it more, I would highly recommend you you get the book and you get the guide as well. Heather, it has been such a pleasure to get to talk to you, and I'm glad we got to go a little further with some other thoughts that I've had since initially reading the book. So it's really just a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You're a wonderful asset to the poetry community.